Do you know what went down at the Viper Room the night River Phoenix died? Or how about the mysterious death of Brittany Murphy? Are you aware of how Steve McQueen escaped murder at the hands of the Manson family? The obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton? The real-life murder that inspired David Lynch's Twin Peaks? The three conspiracies surrounding Marilyn Monroe's death? These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Hollywoodland is hosted by me, Jake Brennan, creator of the award-winning music and true crime podcast, Disgraceland. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to a special edition of On Deadline, where we take you deep into a news story using audio from Odyssey's news and news talk radio stations across the country. It's been less than 48 hours since the United States sent its bunker buster bombs into Iran to destroy their nuclear facilities. And in every moment since, the question has been asked, what will Iran do in response? We got the start of an answer today when Iran launched missile attacks on U.S. military bases in Qatar and Iraq. Qatar said it successfully intercepted the missiles and no casualties were reported. It's the latest in a quickly escalating situation in the Middle East. Here's more from Oakland University International Relations Specialist Dr. Peter Trumbore from WWJ Radio in Detroit.
Their nuclear program, Iran's nuclear program, has been obliterated. How objectively can we assess what kind of damage has really been done?
We can't, actually. So I would be very, very hesitant to say that we have completely eliminated all of Iran's nuclear facilities in every aspect. There was satellite imagery from days before the U.S. attack on Fordo that showed that trucks were coming in and out of the facility. There is some reason to believe that Iran has dispersed its enriched uranium to sites around the country. And so, you know, the president can certainly get on television and say that we've completely obliterated something. But until there is some kind of more independent confirmation than that, I think we have to be really cautious about that claim.
I guess the most obvious question is, what's next? If there's retaliation for these strikes, is that more likely to happen in a regional theater, or should we be concerned about a domestic strike here? And would anybody other than on the Iranian side, other than the Supreme Leader, authorize that?
So in terms of how that would be authorized, that would come, as far as I know, that would come from the Supreme Religious Leader, Khamenei. Now, you know, the extent to which Iran's military command structure remains intact, they've taken a lot of casualties from the Israeli strike. So that's a little tricky to know, but that's where the orders would have to come from. Everybody sort of reports to the top. In terms of what retaliation might look like, I think at this point for the Iranians, I suspect that very little is off the table for them. It'll be easiest for them to strike regionally. There are some 40,000 U.S. service personnel in the region between military bases and naval ships. There are Americans in Iraq, Iranian-allied Shia militia groups in Iraq have targeted Americans in the past. And so I think that that's likely where we'll see the first retaliatory actions. But I would not rule out attacks on American civilian targets, whether here in the U.S. or abroad. So I think we just have to keep our eyes open for those possibilities.
Oakland University International Relations Specialist Dr. Peter Trumbore concerning the overnight developments in Iran. Former U.S. Representative Justin Amash has warned that Trump's actions have put all Americans at risk. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell reminds us that only Congress has the power to declare war. What's your response to this? This is not a declaration of war in a formal sense.
No, because that can only come from Congress. I think what happened here was, in fact, a violation of the Constitution and the War Powers Resolution. You know, the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, said last night that they had followed all of the rules that are embedded in the War Powers Resolution. And he said that they complied with that by informing congressional leaders once American airplanes were out of the theater of operations. Well, that's not how that works, right? The War Powers Resolution requires the administration to notify Congress before military action takes place. And there is no current congressional authorization that would allow the president to unilaterally take military action against a foreign country like Iran, that we do not have sort of an existing authorization for the use of military force against. So, you know, I think Senator Dingell's correct that this was a violation of our constitutional system for how these decisions are supposed to get made. That said, presidents all the time, for years and years, have made these unilateral decisions without Congress having much to say about it. So it doesn't really break new ground in that regard. But I would say Senator Dingell is correct on the legality of the mission.
Congresswoman Dingell, yes, I thank you for that. Peter, listen, nobody has a crystal ball here, but what's your sense? Does the event of last night set us back in the Middle East? And if so, how far? Or have we bullied our way to the front of the line somehow?
No, I think this has made the entire region much more insecure. I think it's put Americans at risk there. It's put American allies at risk. The Iranian parliament has authorized the closing of the Straits of Hormuz, which would interrupt international shipping from the Persian Gulf, which would have an impact on oil, which would have an impact on the global economy. So I think that what this move has done is to make the region less stable and less secure, and has thrown all kinds of things into disarray. And the reality was is there's very little to indicate that Iran was actually close to achieving a nuclear weapon. In fact, Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, had said back in March that Iran was not working on a bomb. Trump the other day said that she was wrong, but there's no indication where he's getting his information from if that information is contradicting our own intelligence services.
Peter, last question in about 45 seconds. How does this impact the conflict between Israel and Hamas? Can Israel sustain two wars simultaneously?
I think they can. I mean, Israel has the most significant military capability in the region, and Hamas has been so significantly degraded that it's hard to see Hamas as being a significant military threat to Israel at this point. I think we're seeing two things, right? It's a ground war in Gaza, and it's an air war over Iran being waged with missiles and drones and aircraft. And I think that allows Israel to carry out that two-front conflict with some, I think, degree of confidence and success.
President Donald Trump now has to thread the needle between his supporters, with whom he has shared a non-interventionist view of the United States, and hawks, and supporters of Israel. For more on the balance the president is trying to strike, here's KCBS political analyst Mark Sandlow.
The obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton, the real-life murder that inspired Twin Peaks. These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.
President Trump has long criticized wars that started under past administrations. Now the U.S. is embroiled in international conflict after Operation Midnight Hammer struck nuclear sites in Iran on Saturday. For more on this, we turn now to the KCBS Ring Central Newsline and talk with the KCBS political analyst Mark Sandlow. And Mark, this whole thing has drawn a line between different factions in the Republican Party.
Yeah, although no one at this point, or very few Republicans, are speaking out, you know, against it. And partly it's because we don't know. I mean, are we at war right now with Iran? It's a little hard to tell. I mean, we just did drop a number of bombs on Iran. So by most definitions, yes, we are at war. At the same time, you know, J.D. Vance, the vice president, insists that this is a very limited strike, that we're not at war with Iran at all. We were at war with their nuclear capabilities, but we're done with that. He says regime change has absolutely nothing to do with this. We're not trying to overthrow the government. As usual in the Trump administration, there's confusion because just a few hours after the vice president said that, the president himself went on social media and Trump said he knows it's politically incorrect to talk about regime change, but why not make Iran great again? And wouldn't a regime change basically be a good thing? So we don't know where we're at. And is typical with the White House, it's hard to get a sense as to whether or not this mission was successful, a complete success, a success at all. I mean, Trump went on national television and said that we have, quote, totally obliterated the Iranian nuclear capacity. That's a huge, huge success. Now he says there was monumental damage, and the folks in the military said we still have to assess it. So there's lots we still need to find out about what happened.
Yeah, it was interesting. It was a precision strike. They're saying no troops. It wasn't aimed at troops or people. This was the nuclear capability. Well, right now, Israel is pounding Tehran as there are calls for de-escalation. So how do you marry those two?
So, that's very tough. And I'll tell you, there is some delusion going on, I think, outside of Iran, if they think that Iran is simply going to accept this without some sort of fight back. I heard the vice president yesterday on one of the Sunday shows, and he said, well, here's what we hope. Iran looks at the mirror, in the mirror, and says, you know, we're not very good at this war thing, and we're not going to win. So here's a gesture. There's an opening for peace. And we just hope that they choose peace. Now, this comes from a man who had just been with the president as he ordered the bombing of this country. It's unlikely that anybody who had just been bombed will say, boy, there's an opening for peace. The truth of the matter is the United States is so much stronger than Iran that it probably is a suicide mission for Iran to do too much fighting back. But there's great threats here. You know, there's worries about, terrorist attacks on U.S. troops overseas, terrorist attacks here in the United States. But Iran is very weakened right now. And until we get more information out of the White House, out of the Pentagon, from Israel and from Iran, it's simply too early to say whether or not this was a very careful and successful strike or the opening of what could be a long and messy war.
Here at home, the potential for further escalation and conflict in the Middle East raises the risk of stagflation, a combination of stagnant economic growth and high inflation. Giacomo Santangelo, senior economics lecturer at Fordham University in New York, discusses more with Odyssey in the Bay Area.
So we saw a spike in oil prices immediately after the bombing, and then we've seen that it retreat a little bit. What are you projecting in the short term?
Well, I think the issue, and you're right to say in the short term, because this is going to have a different, this is expected to have a different effect in the short term than in the long run. I think in the short term, what we're looking at is in this current economic climate where we are concerned about an economic slowdown in the United States of America, the last thing we need is for there to be inflationary spikes due to increasing energy costs. And seeing energy costs go up, especially seeing gasoline prices going up at this time, is really going to adversely affect the average consumer. And that's something that, in terms of other costs going up, is really the last thing that we need.
And uncertainty certainly is the word of the year, if you will. And when it comes to the global oil prices and the energy markets, what are you specifically looking at? And like a worst case scenario, we keep hearing about the Strait of Hormuz, but maybe that's just like too bad of a thing to even look at.
Well, look, sometimes you have to look at the bad thing, and I think that's what we have to look at. Any disruption to the Strait of Hormuz affects not only the United States of America, but China, the European Union. I mean, then you're taking something which potentially is just a U.S. problem, and you're making it the world's problem. And I think that's, a lot of what's going to happen down the road is dependent upon how Iran reacts to this. If they do disrupt transport through the strait, then that is worst case scenario. I think that's what our concern is right now.
Since the U.S. is a net exporter of oil now, what's our ability to weather this if it doesn't last too long, if a spike in prices doesn't last too long?
I think the issue is, regardless of what our supply is, we are, as you said, an exporter. So that means if the world price of oil goes up, the world price of oil goes up. The question of us weathering this, it has to do with our consumption of oil. There are contracts. We're contracted to sell that oil to other countries. So it's not like we're going to now turn around and go, oh, we've decided we're not going to export any oil. We need to export that oil, but we also need to consume it. And if we had some way to use our strategic reserves in order to keep oil prices down in the United States of America, then it's a completely different summer. but it doesn't look like that's on the table. So, traveling down to the beach is going to be uncomfortable for a lot of people.
Oh, what about potential impacts on global trade routes and supply chains?
Well, I mean, again, every single type of transportation of goods is whether we're talking about airplanes, whether we're talking about shipping, we're talking about oil, we're talking about gasoline. And price increases in those areas, you're looking at supply chain, potential supply chain disruptions. And that's just looking at oil's effect. And if we add to that the potential lack of access to the Persian Gulf for suppliers, then it gets even worse.
Okay, you add this on top of tariffs and potential tariffs. Yeah. What are you looking at?
Mm-hmm. You're looking at, as you said before, worst case scenario. You are looking at, we've already projected a slowdown in production in the United States of America by year's end. And we've already projected that inflation will be somewhere in the 3% range by the end of the year. So what you're looking at is stagflation. You're looking at a stagnant economy with rising prices.
Do investors change their behavior during this uncertainty?
It really depends on what sector. Obviously, there's going to be changing. There's going to be some change in the sectors that investors are looking at. As you saw this morning, immediately, as soon as markets opened, oil prices did increase, but now they did pull back briefly. I think everyone is waiting to see what's going to happen in Iran. I think anyone who is dependent upon the transportation of goods is concerned about oil prices. And I think that's really what we're looking at right now. So, you're going to see a flight to safety to a certain degree, because there is an expectation whenever there is war that there's going to be volatility in markets. So people pulling their money out of certain investments and moving to maybe treasuries shouldn't be a surprise.
You mentioned stagflation as a worst case scenario. Tell us how that differs from regular inflation.
Well, when you have inflation, that tends to happen for one of two reasons. Generally, you see rising costs driving firms to increase prices, which is then experienced by consumers, right? We call this cost push inflation. When that is driven by something as important as energy, then what happens is firms not only have to raise prices, but they end up cutting back on production. So now prices are higher and unemployment's rising. So the only thing worse than having prices going up when you have a job is prices going up when you don't have a job. And the reason why this is even worse is because the tools that the Federal Reserve uses to fight inflation make recession worse. And the tools they use to fight recession make inflation worse. So literally, the Federal Reserve has no tools to use to fight stagflation, because they have to choose, do we want to bring unemployment down or do we want to bring prices down?
What do you expect? I mean, I know there's a lot of variables and they always say that
sure,
they're data dependent, but what are you mm-hmm. expecting from the Fed?
I think the Fed has been very transparent recently. President Trump has asked numerous times for the Fed to cut interest rates because it'll give the economy a boost. But the Fed has said that they are concerned about stagflation. They are concerned about inflation still not being where the target is. And they don't feel comfortable cutting interest rates right now. So this, I think right now, the Federal Reserve, investors, and I are all on the same page. Stagflation is a threat, and we want to hopefully avoid it.
So if there's sort of a tit-for-tat response, mm-hmm. Israel fires on Iran, Iran fires on yeah. Israel, other nations in the Middle East are worried about that. How mm-hmm. much of an impact do you expect on the markets here and elsewhere?
Well, I think one of the things that we saw, not to belabor the stagflation point, but you know, the U.S. experiencing the stagflation in the 1970s was as a result of the energy crisis. And that was directly tied, you know, starting in 1973 with war in the Middle East. So this presents several very serious problems for many different markets. And it's not just Israel and Iran. It's not just the United States and Iran. It's the European Union. It's China. It's Japan. It's Africa. It's, you know, this is a global issue. One of the benefits of globalization is that nations of the earth now share in a business cycle. We've kind of synced up our business cycles. When there's inflation in one country, you tend to see it in most countries. When there's recession, that's why the global financial crisis in 2008 was so devastating, was because of globalization, because we all experienced that. So something like this is expected to affect all the nations of the earth, not just the ones that are physically involved in aggression.
Interesting, you know, especially that we're all connected. It seems like there was a push, you know, by some in the United States to insulate ourselves, to become more isolationist. Is this a helpful move? I mean, in some ways you can think of it, well, especially when it comes to energy independence, that probably was a good thing.
I don't think nations that are isolationist bomb other countries. It's getting involved in other nations' wars is the opposite of isolationism, right? When Great Britain at the beginning of World War II decided to kind of turn their back on what was going on in continental Europe, that's isolationism. But the United States has gotten involved in several things that are going on in the world through aid and now through military. And there are, you know, there are repercussions to that. And some of those repercussions are economic in nature. The economic sanctions that we put on Russia when Russia invaded Ukraine, the economic sanctions that were put on Russia before when they invaded Crimea, you know, that's not really isolationist. That's really where we are right now.
What about the defense industry? Do you see them at least benefiting from this?
I think one of the interesting things about the defense industry when the Ukraine war started and there was a question of whether or not U.S. Military contractors were going to get involved, again, this is about contracts and the length of time it takes once a contract is put in and signed for there to be delivery. It's not like we have, you know, large inventory of weapons and such that we can just send out. The weapons that have already been produced have already been produced. So in order for those military contractors to make lots and lots of money, that's on new production. And that's for delivery years from now, not for immediate delivery. So, yeah, of course, there is a benefit financially to military contractors when war happens. But it's more of a long-term thing than an immediate benefit.
We've seen some disruption to air travel. Just this mm-hmm. morning, Qatar closing its airspace amid Iranian retaliation threats to the United States.
Sure.
Well, it won't impact American tourism. It's going to be impacting tourism in the Middle East. Who do you think mm-hmm. would be most impacted? Some of those places aren't really popular for Americans to visit. Who could be impacted there?
Well, I think anywhere. It really is a question of, at a moment's notice, you can shut down an airport and you can say we're limiting air traffic. At a moment's notice, you can limit air traffic over specific airspace. So it really is a question of who's going to decide to limit their air travel. And as far as, you know, down the road, not for nothing, but the United States is going to be hosting the World Cup of soccer in the future. And so there are repercussions to, you know, economic repercussions to this, given the popularity of soccer, of football in the Middle East. So it'll be interesting to see down the road how this impacts the United States, since so many
areas, so many cities in the United States are going to be dependent upon that income.
Yeah, I think we all worry about sort of what they used to call mission creep, us getting more and more involved in this, and what the economic repercussions of that would be.
Yeah, I think that is a valid concern, but it has been a very long time since we've had those conversations. Those were conversations that were very, very big up until the Gulf War, the first and second Gulf War. And there's been a lot of discussion about the United States getting out of international wars, avoiding international wars. Something that President Trump ran on was you know, us not being involved in foreign wars. And by last count, there are at least two that we are currently involved with, either peripherally or directly. And while I know that we are not at war, I know that this is not, you know, everybody saying this, we are not at war with Iran. But, you know, the military is involved. And so, again, there is a question of how Iran is going to respond to this. I know that the foreign minister of Iran is apparently meeting with President Putin. And so we'll see how that turns out. And we'll just have to see moving forward what happens on the other side, and then how we respond, and how, you know, how that works out, and how it affects the average American consumer. Because, you know, whether American consumers are for or against these things that are happening, they are affected by it.
How should the individual consumer protect themselves then?
I think the issue at this point is that it's happening. And as far as protecting oneself, this is where we are. It started to rain, and, you know, you're going to get wet. That's really what it is.
Be comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this edition of On Deadline. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
The obsessive killing of Dorothy Stratton, the real-life murder that inspired Twin Peaks. These stories and more are told in the Hollywoodland podcast, where true crime and Tinseltown collide. Follow and listen to Hollywoodland wherever you get your podcasts.